Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Taylor Moore from Fortunate Horse. He is the creative director and composer for the stunning actual play Worlds Beyond Number. And if you've been listening to this show for a while, you've heard an extended conversation we've been having over years that we will continue today. Taylor Moore, welcome back to the table.
Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me. I loved your little intro.
It's a great little intro.
Thank you.
Listener, they were apologizing for their quote-unquote dumb intro before we started recording. And I didn't think that was dumb at all. Tell these cute boys what a good, cute job they're doing, huh?
Yeah. And do it in the form of a five-star review on your podcast player of choice.
I want you taking your hands off the steering wheel of your motorized vehicle and or construction heavy machinery and giving these boys a round of applause. Stand up in your car.
Preferably if you're presently in a roundabout.
Yes.
Taylor, good to have you back.
It's great to be back. Let me tell you, life post-finale is a good life.
We're catching you in the summer of your year, in the summer of your production schedule.
For
folks at home,
thank you. Yes.
You're glowing. For folks at home, just a quick heads up that this is not going to be a super story focused interview for The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One, but we will not be shying away from major spoilers for Chapter 4 and Book 1 as a whole. So cautious listening ahead. If you don't want that show spoiled, now is your final warning.
And go start listening. It's the best time.
And go start listening.
It's the best time to start. Without the 2-week wait between episodes, I think the show is even stronger.
I bet it's a good binge.
But it's also not fair. Because I think that the people who listened and went through the wait, because it bugs me that I watch people like watching Lost on, binging Lost on Netflix or whatever. And I that's stolen valor. Because those of us that were there, it's a different experience.
You're trying to say they didn't earn it.
They didn't earn it.
They didn't earn it.
We suffered every week waiting on that show. And it's like, it's a different experience. It's a different experience to have to wait and listen and remember. And I think those are the real heroes. Better than the troops? Yes!
Yes, some are saying. And that's why you're deleting the whole book off of Spotify.
Yeah.
Listen, you have 2 weeks.
Listen, there are millions of Redditors that are below the IQ line to where they will believe that is true. You can't joke around about that.
Yeah, see, but I have the power of the edit, so we can just cut out that sentence.
Yes, yes. Speaking of the power of the edit, that's a lot of what you do. Over there at Worlds Beyond Number. Oh, look at me.
Great
segue,
transition.
Professional podcaster. So we're here at the end of book one. We spoke to you right at the end of arc one, and the big question there was, did we pull it off? And at the time we were like, yeah, you pulled it off. And now I think 3 full arcs later, I'm kind of curious how the answer to that question differs. I mean, I think it's still a yes from our perspective as listeners, but like how that your feelings of the did you pull it off have changed in these 3 arcs since we last spoke.
I think we pulled it off. Especially like the ending to arc 4, like the finale of the first book, I think landed very, very well with people, which is, and we had the gods were with us on that, in the finale episodes. We got incredibly lucky, the dice and the chance, just everything kind of came together and was on our side. But yeah, I think we pulled it off. I think we did all right.
And now you're staring down. You now have a break. You have a weight off your shoulders now that campaign one is, book one of Wizard, the Witch and the Wild One is done. But now you are staring down just a few months in the distance, the behemoth that is and will be campaign 2.
And I'm putting together the original soundtrack for book one of The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One in these months.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's very cool.
And we're releasing 2 miniseries and, a bunch of other stuff. And I still want to go back and fix a lot. You know, when I said that, yes, we pulled it off, what I mean is We landed the plane without total party kill. Like, we did not disappear over the South Indian Sea. You know what I mean? We successfully landed the plane at the airport that we initially set out to land on. But there's parts of the engine that are smoking. I wasn't really happy with the in-flight snack options, and I do kind of want to go back and fix some mistakes and rewrite some cues in some episodes. So, you know, nothing's perfect. But yes, we are looking, given, you know, put the go back and George Lucas the shit out of the original episodes, right. Which is always, that's always a temptation.
People always add love that.
Oh yeah, they'd love it. They wouldn't notice. I'm not gonna like put a big CGI monster in front of like a fun NPC to block them. But just, you know, there's some mixing I want to fix. There's a couple of cues I'd love to rewrite. But yeah, add that on top of making the soundtrack. We're releasing all these miniseries and stuff based on the Wizard of the Witch and the Wild One. We've got interludes coming up, which means like one-off set in the world of the Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One. And then, of course, Abria Iyengar's big first opus, her first big long campaign launching early next year, getting ready for that. It's a big one.
Now that you're getting to set up for that campaign too, you essentially, you kind of get to start from zero again. You kind of get to fully learn from the lessons of all of campaign one in a way that you can't do between, like, once you're in it, you're in it. Once you've made decisions in episode one, you kind of have to continue it on. What are you looking at the start of campaign two? Like, what are you doing right now to prep that campaign for success, for your, you know, to make it even more sustainable than, I don't know if you've actually made the show sustainable yet, but to make it sustainable, to make it easier and better. And also just like, what are the lessons you've learned from book one that you're hoping to take into book two or into campaign two?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you one thing that we're not doing is when we launched, see, the launch of The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One coincided with the launch of the entire project, right? So Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One launched at the same time as Worlds Beyond Number and the Patreon page. So really, you have the company launching at the same time our first big narrative was launching. And so what we did to help boost that launch, and I think it was a really great design for a funding campaign, is on day one, you know, we released a 2.5 hour pilot episode, an hour and change of preludes, and 8 or 9 episodes of Session Zero content, what we call the children's adventure, right? So releasing, like, I can't, like, if someone had stopped me at the time and said, Taylor, think about what you're doing, I really could have benefited from that. But as a marketing strategy, as a funding strategy, as a launch strategy, that worked gangbusters. Launching the Patreon and the project with so much story available for subscribers on day one was an enormous success, but it was a production challenge that I literally never bounced back from. So we were putting out so much stuff on day one, I was never able to get ahead of the production schedule as much as I'd like. So as soon as episode 10 ended, I was at editing episode 11 for release 2 weeks later, right? And that was a 2 years of a production, like a stress machine you can't imagine, because our launch strategy was so production intensive that I didn't see it coming, and we weren't able to get ahead. And so I was producing the show up until the deadline, like every single time. And whenever we had a break, it was like, well, I could spend Christmas getting ahead.
or I could spend Christmas
seeing another human being and having right. them give me physical contact and affection and seeing how my nephews are doing, et cetera, et cetera. You know, because otherwise I'm just sort of locked in here in the Skinner box of the Fortunate Horse studio. So we will not be doing that with their previous new show. I'm not going to put out 24 hours of content on day one. Maybe we'll have a little something, but I'm not going to go that heavy. So that's definitely one lesson we learned. Another lesson I've learned is have help. You know, when we launched Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One, I did not have Jared Olson, who is my editing and sound design partner for life at this point. I will hang on to that man by the ankles as the world tries to drag him away from me, who's been just instrumental to both the production and creative success of the show since he joined us in book two, arc two, when we're at the Citadel in the Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One. So I have help now, and I'm looking to hire for more help. It's just building out the team. You know, we've been really fortunate that to see a lot of growth in the last year, especially the last 6 months, and that enables the way, I don't want to get too much into the details, but the way we're structured is the production budget is very much tied to the growth of the show. So the production budget doesn't increase until the entire take increases. And so as the show grows, we develop more of a production bandwidth, and that has been a game changer that I can bring on as much help as I need. That's a huge win for us. So yeah, there's a lot going in differently into Solari. Also thinking just differently about how I produce the music. You know, the vibe for The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One was very much like mid to late 20th century adventure serial, right? So I was looking to Alan Silvestri and John Williams and all the great, you know, fun adventure, genre adventure composers back then, and the romantics and everything. And so that path leads you to a phenomenon where you are writing a 20-track orchestral full symphonic cue that only lasts a minute, 30 seconds. But, you know, the arrangement and the instrumentation is fairly sophisticated if you want to stay within the genre. Was every cue like that? No, but a hell of a lot of them were. And the more important the episode to the story, the more pressure there was to deliver a score that was as sophisticated and as grand as the story itself. And that is a very production-intensive way to score anything, which is why most movies don't do that anymore. You know, one of the reasons that the industry sort of left that style behind is it's more financially sustainable and profitable to do like modern hybrid scoring is what they call it. Now the new show will not have giant, fully arranged and orchestral pieces. We're looking much more towards, I'm building a giant modular synthesizer. You know, you can see the pieces behind me here on camera. Sorry, listeners, you'll just have to wait for the bone cone I released on the Patreon to see it. So doing a whole different style of music that is much more about timbre and vibe than it is 20 layers of different string and woodwind, you know, passages. So that's going to change things enormously as well. So not only are we looking at the kind of content, but the production bandwidth, size of the team, all that sort of stuff is very different going into the second book. So I'm optimistic.
I'm always curious to talk to you about like composition and your journey with it, because it's the thing that is most closely tied to your journey with this show, because it was something that you did not do before making this show and working on this project. Since we spoke to you last at the end of Arc 1, I'm curious, creatively and technically, maybe they're tied, maybe they're separate, are the things that you've grown and learned the most about composition and like music as part of this, as a device for your work?
Oh, so much. I mean, you could listen to book one and book four. I mean, it sounds like they're made almost by a different person a lot of times. I think that I didn't really get a handle on it until the end of book one. I think that the climax of book one is where I really started to like, you know, just read, anytime you're learning something, you just sort of enter these different stages where you have enough of a grasp on enough of the fundamentals to where you can sort of move freely on a new tier. And that was the end of book one is definitely me breaking through as a musician to like a new place, right? Understand things better and to feel more free to make things a bit larger. And then you hear book four, which has some of my favorite stuff I made. I mean, even just the overture for book four in that first episode is more sophisticated than the entire first season on its own, both as it works as like a structural piece for the tone and the score of the entire book, the entire arc of four, and just as a standalone thing. And also, arc four has the Battle of Abyssin in it and the Battle of 12 Brooks in it, which are, you know, I mean, those were like titanic undertakings that there's 0% chance I could have pulled that off in book one, arc one. God, I cannot. It's really hard to come up with names and keep them consistent. This new media shit. I'll tell you that, man. But yeah, whenever I'm not working, if I'm working out or just hanging out, I have in my hand a phone or I'm looking at some other screen that is playing a composition, arrangement, music tutorial. That is my life. It's just, I am constantly trying to pick that up. But now I'm shifting. Now it's all no more orchestral stuff. YouTube still is trying to give me string arrangement tips. And now it's all synthesizers, baby. It's like, you know, how do I make that same drum sound that like Afrika Bambaataa used? You know, like how do I get like a Vangelis tone rather than how do I stack 10 different cellos on each other to sound like the Philharmonic?
And in that new process of like figuring out synthesizers and this like new mode of music, where do you think you're at in the process?
I'm a baby. Wah, wah, goo, goo, gaga. I am a baby. And I don't know why I do this to myself. I do know why I do this to myself, because there's a part of me very deep down that thinks that your work is not valuable unless you suffered to make it, which is not entirely wrong and not entirely true. But I feel like coasting feels like cheating. Coasting feels like if I know that I'm coasting, I feel that I do not have a right to be heard or to be successful. So I'm always trying to like reinvent and figure something new out, some new thing. And now I get to start from scratch with this world. And I'm super pumped for it. I can't wait to make Beeps and Boops. I'm also listening to, for the new show, for a Bria Space Campaign, I'm also listening to like a lot of like early hip hop stuff and a lot of New Order and a lot of early like synth pop and like new wave. I'm listening to a lot of new wave and early hip hop, which have a lot of crossover if you get into the history of it, because they're all based on the same like two drum machines and handful of synthesizers in that world. But also, yeah, Vangelis and Hans Zimmer and all that grand. How do we tie the big, great, grand space stuff to the intimacy and urgency of like a tight spaceship corridor fight with laser guns and shit like that? How do you make those two things together in the more modern mode? So those are the questions I'm thinking about now.
I don't know if this is like too much of a thought for Campaign 2 that you might not want to share yet, but if anyone's listening to this and is excited for Campaign 2, do you have any music recommendations that will get them in the vibe of what you're getting excited about for Campaign 2?
Oh, shit. No. Well, because the thing is,
you heard it here first, listeners. The exclusive scoop.
Well, music wise, I want the new show to be a lot more eclectic. Because we were really tired. You know, there were times I strayed from like the classic adventure serial vibe. And like when Sly came on, or when the Fox would go spying and sneaking, you would hear like a much more modern jazz influenced like snare drum little thing behind him or something, you know, with a bass or something. But other than a few moments like that, the score really kept true to like the classic romantic adventure sort of stuff. I do not want to do that with the next show. Because think of how much bigger the setting is. If we're talking about like potentially an entire galaxy of different civilizations, different technologies, all these different things. So like we need a much larger palette, much larger palette. So I think the sound is going to be much more eclectic and even esoteric and going to involve a lot of different sounds. I mean, if you want to go listen to Power and Corruption and Lies by New Order, that's a great album. You can listen to that anytime you want. I've been listening to a lot of Alice Coltrane, a lot of Vangelis, like a lot of the great like synth film scores from the 70s and 80s is what I'm looking at. Like everything from like 75 to 89, all the new wave stuff, all the great sci-fi movies that came out around that time. That's what I'm looking at.
I also loved hearing the addition of some like extra Americana at the end of book one.
Yeah.
Is that like heading off to the free roads or?
Yeah. Well, the free roads, you know, I saved guitars for the free roads. So we'll be hearing a lot more about that. And I've already got a banjo live here in the studio that you'll be hearing for book two.
Oh, hell yeah.
I want to talk about audience next, and thinking about you've had this audience that has followed Worlds Beyond Number until this point. And now we're, like Brian said, you're staring down the barrel of a fresh start with a new campaign. And I think with not doing the crazy big, you're getting 30 hours of content. What are the ways like you're thinking about holding on to the trust of this audience and being like, hey, join us on this new adventure. It's going to be the same kind of stuff you love.
I think we are going to try and do that. Like that is definitely something on my mind, but I don't think we have to try that hard in that regard. Like especially for our patrons, right? Like the people, our subscribers, like actual paid subscribers, our patrons. We've got a great relationship with that crowd. And they are a smart, warm crowd, right? Not just warm as in they're warmed up, but like just spiritually. They are a warm people in general. You know, they get it. And they, especially given like Abria's incredible performance in The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One, which I think is like one of the landmark actual play player performances of the medium. I think it's remarkable. It is a character that is as sophisticated as the most top-tier fantasy novels. right? You know, I really feel that way. I mean, if you don't trust us and if you don't trust Abria, now I don't know what to fucking tell you. These are, come on. Even if we shit the bed, we're going to be trying so hard, it'll be fun to watch us try. And that is my philosophy on everything. I cannot promise you success in every attempt and every endeavor, but I sure as hell promise you that I will be trying so hard that even if I fail, it'll be a spectacular failure and you'll enjoy watching us shit the bed. At the very least, it'll sound good. But that is something I'm thinking about. So I think that as we get closer to game time and as we start doing more warm-up stuff, you might see us start to share some behind the scenes from the preparations going into the game for our patrons, being like, this is how we're making it. And we're still talking about what to do and how to do that amongst ourselves right now. So expect, I think when we get into wintertime and it approaches launch, expect to see some like behind the scenes stuff, watch us build it in preparation for launch.
And then kind of on that same note of like keeping the audience you have, how are you looking at, because this is, again, it's a reset point. It's a new jumping on point for a new audience. How are you looking to bring in new audiences for this campaign?
Well, you hope, new genre, like some people just don't dig on fantasy stuff. So if we do good space stuff, we'll get the sci-fi nerds, Also, the tone's going to be different. I mean, like inevitably the tone's going to be very, very different. The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One, very much based on this Miyazaki duality of like the horrors and realities of industrial warfare matched against like the pure, hard-on-the-sleeve, childlike whimsy and wonder of the sacred domestic life, right? That is the Miyazaki duality, which enforces a certain tone on the show, which I think we nailed wonderfully. And when I say we, I mean mostly, of course, the cast did a wonderful job. Whereas I doubt that is the vibe that will happen in our space setting. Abria and I have had our first few big creative meetings about big questions of world and structure and things like that. And I don't know how much whimsy I would expect out of, the brutal economics of faster than light travel in the galaxy that we're building.
There's not going to be pixies without buttholes in it?
There's definitely going to be wonder. Baby, listen, I got some synthesizers here and some reverb pedals. If I don't get to do some big impressive washes of, communicating the immensity and grandeur of space, I will have, I've shit the bed. That's on me. No, we're still going to have wonder and stuff, but like the setting's different. Tone's going to be different. So now we have not recorded a single session. So I'm talking completely out of my ass here, right? Maybe we end up doing the exact same thing. But I think, some people aren't going to go for the like hard on your sleeve whimsy and wonder of the Miyazaki-esque setting of Umura. They might want something that's a little more sarcastic, a little more, I hesitate to say mature because that casts warmth and emotional openness as an immature instead of a mature thing, but they might I don't know if Ame would make it in the galaxy that we're proposing. That might be too tough on her. We'll see. But there's different characters. Already I know enough to say that like Erica's character in the new campaign is very, very different from Ame, and we'll be seeing a very different side of Erica. It's going to be fantastic. So some things I know are already becoming their opposites for the new campaign. So one thinks that the tone change might be different. Also, we're actually seeing some audience growth now just based on word of mouth. People, the last couple of episodes of book one of The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One got a lot of people talking, and that is the only reliable audience growth these days that exists. Like, that's it. It's hard out there. It is hard out there. There is no press that covers us. And the press that does cover us are preaching to an audience that already knows about us. So, like, when a game's there is no more games journalism. There is no real podcast journalism. There is not really any good entertainment journalism, to be completely honest, unless you count, the two times a year someone writes a good essay about a TV show we're all watching. There's just not a lot of reporting. So it used to be you could rely on someone with a big audience and a big outlet writing about you, giving you a good review, and then you'd see a big influx of people. That, as far as I know, that doesn't happen anymore, and it doesn't happen to anyone I know anymore. That is very difficult to make happen. Maybe if there's a very small, high-quality project that that someone discovers, they might be able to increase that. But that would require so much digging on their part because there's so much content, it just doesn't happen very often. It's rough out there. So, the social media networks are now, well, they all bifurcated, right? We now have there's this diaspora of social networks where no one has as big of a consistent a following as they used to. Instagram doesn't convert, and disappearing posts on TikTok or Instagram don't convert anything. So even if someone really famous with a huge following points you out to people, if they do it on an Instagram story, it doesn't fucking matter. If 10 million people could see it, you don't get one new listener from that. It's really tough out there. But the one thing that's very reliable is word of mouth. Everyone telling their own networks and their friends and their family and the real world. That shit still works. So, but you got to work so hard to get people's attention for that sort of thing. It's wild. But we have seen the finale generated a lot. The Critical Role announcement that Brennan will be GMing the next arc of Critical Role. And Abria's on the cast for that. I'm so glad to finally be able to talk about this. I've been holding that secret for so fucking long. But that's up, and we're getting a lot of attention from that. People are discovering the show because of Abria and Brennan being associated with Critical Role. Just great, love that. So, we've been seeing a lot of growth in new audience the last 6 months that we did not see for the previous year and a half.
It is wild to, I guess I, you know, in my head, and I'm sure in anyone who runs an actual play or even considers actual play, it's wild to look at Worlds Beyond Number and think that they're having the same difficulties growing as My First Dungeon or as Planet Arcana or as any other actual play show. Like, you'd think that in that tier it is a different story, but ultimately we're all still playing the same game.
We're all still playing the same game, yeah. I mean, look, it's very different because we had a very successful launch and that made it so that none of us are starving to death. You know, none of us are going hungry. 9 out of 10 months, I don't worry about paying the mortgage. You know, that's still a concern. You know, the project pays for itself as long as our production people work their fucking asses off. That's the catch, right? The project pays for itself. So it's not like we're desperate. Right out of the gate, the project started paying for itself, and that takes a lot of pressure off. But here's the thing. The reason the project paid for itself is because we launched with people who had a large pre-existing following. Full stop. That is the truth in the case. And I think we also debuted a lot of really fantastic story and production and sounds right out of the gate. I'm very proud of the preludes that we published to get people's attention. I think they were very good and that helped. But look, no bullshit. We launched well because we had we had famous people on the show. That's just the truth. That's the business. But we didn't grow. Once that launch happened, the growth was really, really flat for a very, very long time. Right? Having a big pre-existing audience gets you a good launch, but if you want to hold people, and especially if you want to grow, you got to bust your ass to impress the shit out of them. Because the only way the show's going to grow is if the listeners tell everybody they know, and the only way they're going to do that is if they are so impressed that they can't not do it. You know? So it's still a lot of work. But yeah, I mean, here's the thing too. Everyone on my show is faced every day with incredible opportunities. Think of how many people want Abria, Brennan, Eric, and Lou's attention. Lou has a full-time network TV job. That shit is a lot of work. They ask you to stay late all the time. You got to come in early. Oh, you got to write jokes for Pedro Pascal. It's a lot of work. Late-night TV comedy is famously a grueling work schedule on the people in it. And it's no less so, for Lou. And so he's got a full-time day job. God knows Brennan is the most employed man on earth. Probably does more in a day than high-level government officials. Sometimes I think about the guys, in the silos of our nuclear warheads playing ping pong and killing time while Brennan, who's making up stories about gnomes, is working 20 hours a day. Very, very funny to me. Jokes on Brennan, I think, very clearly there. Those people, we all love this project. They love this project. We are all very proud of it. But the economic reality is anything involving those people is in competition with every other movie, TV show, whatever, project that those people are being offered all the time. And so if if a project is flat, I mean, it keeps me up at night sometimes, you know, like if we have a down month, does that make a cast member more likely to go take on another project and we lose that cast member? Does that then create a negative feedback loop where the project collapses? And this isn't just for Worlds Beyond Number. This is for everything I've ever worked on. Everything I've ever worked on, one of my main concerns is how do I make this count for the cast so I keep them? How do we make it valuable so that everyone stays on board? And so for us to be competitive, we need to grow. We need to always be a sustainable, profitable business because the people I work with are at a place in their careers where they're not going to do much out of charity. You know what I mean? Not because they're bad people, but just the time. Why do a labor-intensive podcast for less money than doing commercials for Geico? Doesn't make any sense. So I always want to, you know, give people the value proposition to where they can, which is the whole point of Fortunate Horse, is to create opportunities exactly like that, where creative people can be independent and masters of their own domain and have agency in their art and careers without the pressure to constantly go for these, you know, soul-sucking commercial jobs. So, yeah, so like, Even we, you know, worry about growth, and especially me, you know, who wants everyone to stay incentivized to stay on board. Yeah, we worry about growth, and it's hard. Even with huge audiences and everything, it is difficult. I mean, like we will have like big outlets write about us. Does not move the needle at all. Not at all. Nothing.
That is a thing that I've more and more the more we do this, I come to terms with of like, doesn't matter. Anything you do, there's nothing that can be an accurate predictor of success or an accurate predictor of growth. It's just, it's going to happen slowly and over time. And that there's something that sucks about that. Like it sucks that there's not a magic bullet that anyone has really been able to find.
Well, the problem is the magic bullet is very expensive, which is just like sacrifice your life to make the best thing you possibly can.
Well, and that's the thing. I find it both disheartening in that it's, there's nothing out there that's going to make this happen easily, but also kind of heartening in if you realize that that is not the case, if that can never happen, there's not going to be a big magic bullet, then it's like, okay, how do I reorganize my life to just do this a little bit at a time? And that little bit is still a lot of work, but like through making the shows that we make, I now have developed some like patterns and habits and things that I'm like, okay, work this much every day. Some days are going to be good. Some days are going to be bad. It will fluctuate. But at the end of a month, you will have this to contribute. And that if you can keep that consistent, if you can keep working, keep improving, keep doing these little things here and there, then you're going to continue to maintain that trust of the audience, continue to grow, continue to improve and be proud of your work. And hopefully, if you can, you know, sustain that and make it a part of your life and something that is fun and rewarding and exciting to continue to do, then this, the train kind of runs itself. It still is run by a shit ton of work and effort, but it is a thing that you have now trained yourself to do in the way that you go to a gym in the same way.
Yeah, it's so hard to balance that. But I think, but trying to balance it is a game worth playing, even if we fuck it up and lose. You know, otherwise, what do? Sit on your ass all your life? Or think about what could have been? Fuck that. World's ending. Have fun. Try. Make your thing.
The world's ending. Make your thing. That's absolutely true. It's the talk of the
table. Hey, this is Brian, and I just want to tell you about some cool new stuff from our friends at Hero Forge. Hero Forge offers fully customizable tabletop minis with dozens of fantasy species and thousands of parts to choose from, all within your web browser. Hero Forge is constantly releasing new content, and they've just launched their latest feature, custom acrylic keychains. These keychains use the same technology as their color standees and are the perfect way to rep your beloved character when you're out in the world. They are highly detailed, ridiculously durable, and made of 1/8-inch thick acrylic featuring front and back color printing, measured on the same 30mm scale as Hero Forge minis and standees, which means they will be a one-for-one match for your heroes on the battle map. Plus, Hero Forge just released stainless steel minis. These are perfect for anyone who is looking for the retro feel of old-school minis. These stainless steel minis have a textured finish and a rugged, highly durable feel. So visit heroforge.com to start designing your custom keychains and steel minis today.
You see, looking up from the ground, blood-red clouds boiling across the sky.
You did ask me to bring the thunder.
Dejin! Help! I've got the chalice, please!
Well, if they're following you, then I guess that takes care of a loose end for me.
All of you feel the earth beneath you shake and crack and break.
I feel that I have failed both of you, and I am sorry for that.
This has nothing to do with you being a bad leader.
Do you want a countdown? Oh, I think I want a countdown.
I wanted to help. I always had good intention. I did not deserve to die.
Now.
The Lucky Die Podcast is a weekly 5e Dungeons & Dragons actual play podcast. Join our adventure every Monday wherever you download podcasts by searching for The Lucky Die.
My dearest listener, have I got a secret for you? Bitterton is an improvised comedy podcast inspired by the stories of Jane Austen that tells the tale of a wealthy family's secrets, scandals, and shenanigans. Lady Bitterton has unwed daughters, nosy neighbors, awful country cousins, and now a body to hide. Will the Bitchertons be able to keep their secrets off the pages of Lady Bigwither's gossip sheet? Or will her pen skewer their good name forever? Oh, Bits, what a predicament. Featuring the voices of Katie Maravich, Iffy Waddyway, Carolyn Page, Alex Songsharp, Brian Flaherty, and Cassie Wilson, plus a dance card filled with guest comedians of the very finest quality. But for us to help the seeds of rumor ripen into the juicy plum of scandal, we'll need your help. Bitcherton is heading to Kickstarter on June 13th. Go to bitcherton.com to pre-save the campaign and help us bring this story to life. Ta-ta for now.
I was saying this to Elliot a couple of days ago, that when I was a kid, I really wanted to write books. Like, it was when my answer of what he wanted to be when you grow up from like age, you know, 1 to 15 was an author. And I don't know if that's the case anymore. But what I do know about myself, I don't know if a book I write would be any good, worth reading, successful, would function as a novel. But I know now with the work that I've done and the habits that I've created through like podcasting and editing and stuff, that I could write X amount of words a day and finish a novel. Would it be any good? I have no idea. Would it be worthwhile? I have no idea. But I could have, at the end of X months, 150,000 words done, which is nice to know that you've built the skills to maintain that kind of work.
Yeah, I think like writing a book to me, especially like a big, thick novel, is the ur example of a person struggling through making a thing. I feel like writing a book is that, you know, for a lot of people, I think like that's the example of like a person going off in a room alone and just hunkering down and making a work. I couldn't do it. I need deadlines. I need other people watching me and being involved. If it was just me in a room making a book, could not do it.
Actually, you know, kind of talking about deadlines, I know you're planning this campaign to fix the problems of deadlines of campaign one. But also work expands to fit available time. What instruments or what mechanisms are you trying to put in place? Or how are you trying to plan to save yourself from yourself?
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. That's a good question. But, you know, I think that subscribers of the show will know that, like, there was a couple of times where we had to delay episode releases by a few days and a handful where, you know, come out later on release day. And that is because we are scheduling and production bandwidth are like a pipe. Like, right, it's like the pipe is a certain size. And we are and our creative ambitions are bigger than the diameter of the pipe. You know? So we are trying to fit a thing that is bigger than the pipe through the pipe. And when that happens, something's got to break, right? Either you cut off pieces of the thing you're trying to fit through the pipe, or the pipe stretches, or the pipe breaks. And we always made the choice, stretch the pipe. Like the pipe, at the end of the day, the pipe doesn't matter. The pipe is there. Now, if you stop publishing for months, that's going to hurt the business. That's going to, your fans are not going to trust you, right? But if you stay generally consistent and the thing coming through the pipe moves people, then no one really cares if the pipe stretches that much. They might care for a few hours on a Tuesday afternoon, but once it's out, you know, it's a few hours late for a few hours, but then once it's out, it's good forever. And people coming to the show now, they don't give a shit. They don't care. And so this idea that everything has got to come out in lockstep precision is based on mostly a vestigial production belief that comes from the days of non-on-demand, like time-bound broadcast mass media, TV and radio. And it comes from the ad model of indie culture, where the people buying eyes and ears on your program want everything to be down to the second as consistent as possible because that makes their data more reliable. We're not on TV. We're not on radio. We don't have advertisers. I think of our production a lot more like someone releasing books than I do a TV show. Whereas, you know, like someone might release books a few years apart, a few months apart, who knows? So consistency is important, but like I always think the pipe stretching is fine a little bit. Otherwise, why are we doing this? Why do we have this infinitely flexible distribution model and technology if we're not going to take advantage of the fact that it allows us to stretch the pipe in service of a larger creative vision? That being said, the emotional journey I go on in the 24 hours that is going on, and not so nice when your physical body turns into the stretch pipe. I'm not going to get too graphic, but, you know, come on. Sometimes it's not as fun as it looks on the videos.
I am the pipe.
Yeah, when you're the pipe, it doesn't feel great. So honestly, like, yeah, I mean, getting out just so – we're really trying to get out ahead of the big thing is – not editing the show up until release date to give ourselves some time, which thank God is built in enormously at the point of the schedule now, where we're gonna be so far ahead of production come the end of the year, looking good.
I mean, I'm just gonna challenge you on this because I think everything for the past 2 or 3 years, your reason to publish something is because there's a deadline.
Yes.
If you're giving yourself 3 months, do you think you're gonna be able to? Because I know I'm guilty of this too. Like,
yeah.
If I don't have that hard deadline, I want to fit it a little bit more.
I am so enamored and charmed by you for pushing back on this. This is so really gutsy. Good. Nobody else would do this.
I'm worried about you. Like I want to set you up for success here.
Yeah.
Let's hold accountable to this.
Personally, here. So I'm thinking about that too. And just like personally. Right, this has nothing to do with Worlds Beyond Number. This is just like how I personally relate to labor and expectations and all that stuff. I am bringing a lot more people into the process. So there's more eyeballs on me and I have a lot more throughput. And we have a new operations manager at Worlds Beyond Number. Oh gosh, she's so great. I don't know, we haven't had the discussion if she wants her name like out in public associated with the show. Some people don't. But anyway, she's wonderful. She's helped me out a lot. So there's more eyeballs, there's more people. For instance, I was the only person working full-time on Worlds Beyond Number and now there's two of us. Very happy about that. It's so great. I'll be hiring more beyond Jared. I'll be hiring some more like assistant editors and things like that to work on different audio in different ways. So I think more people helping, more eyeballs in the room, and the fact that every day I'll be less alone working on it, I think is going to help me personally with, yeah, keeping things up. And also, no excuses, right? We made a very complicated decision. I made a very complicated decision about that giant launch of all the content up front, which pushed us back into a really back against the wall production schedule, whereas that is not occurring this time. So yeah, the expectations are very different going forward of me on myself. Like, no one's yelling at me about this, to be clear.
Well,
no
one is yelling at me. I am yelling at you about this.
Well, I'll take your yelling any day.
Yeah. I'm curious because kind of on that note of expanding the team and adding more people, adding more eyeballs to the project, this past season of My First Dungeon, when we played Slug Blaster, was really the first time we've worked with an outside editor. Jay Stroutman came in, and this is the first time we've worked with an outside editor for an extended season type thing. Jay Stroutman came in and did the sound design for episodes 2, 4, 6, and 8. And I'm curious how you feel about the arc of your, what's the word? The arc of your involvement with the project and how you relate to the project from episode 1, where you did everything, to now, as it's going on, there are more people involved. You are less involved in some areas of it. You still have the oversight of it, but your hands are off the keyboard for more and more of it. I'm at the very beginning of that journey, and I'm curious how you felt, what your relationship to the project is and how it changes as more people are brought in to the project.
Well, I mean, this is something that I struggled with in my early days. I was always, and this is beyond Worlds Beyond Ever, this is just me as a producer and a writer, a composer in general. I struggled with that very much in the early days. I was very hesitant to ask for help for a lot of reasons. A lot of them, most of them, financial terror, right? Because help costs money. And if you don't have money, you're sure as shit not going to ask for help. Of course, then sometimes you get in a situation where if you're not willing to spend money, you don't get the bandwidth, and that means you can't make more money later, you know? I mean, that's something that especially those of us that are trying to make not just passion projects, but like sustainable businesses out of our creative work, that is always, it's not a science. It is really an art, because that involves a lot of emotional journeys, and you have to change. If you have to open yourself to belief and trust in other people, which is, might not come naturally to you at all or in a certain situation. And I struggled that early on asking for help. And then there was a time where I very much tried to put together a team of people to help me, and I really fucked it up. And I hired people, I think, for some of the wrong reasons. And I hired people and then didn't do a very good job of, like, helping them figure out what to do. And so it fell apart. It didn't work. And what I thought was going to be my lifeboat, what I thought was going to be a big help, actually turned into a time and money sink that made my general ability to perform less. You know, and that was a huge loss. I mean, that was the worst beat I've had as like a producer or in my creative career. Those were very dark days because I felt like I had let down the people I was supporting creatively, and I had let down the people that I had brought in to help, and I was just sort of trapped in that situation. But thank God, that's not a lesson I had to learn 2 times. Since then, I've been building up a group of people that I work with, To be fair, you are one of them. So, you know, listener, caveat emptor, he's on the inside of this, that I think I'm much better at working with, and that I'm able to trust. And I feel like over the last 2 years, I've built out a team of independent editors and composers and, you know, freelancers and contractors and all these folks that I really trust and love working with. And where once I was terrified of other people, quote unquote, touching my work. Fuck off, Taylor. Taylor in the past, asshole. Get that guy out of here. Now it's like when I see a chance to work with them, I get excited. It's like, oh, this is going to be so great. Like, oh, this person's perfect for this. Or like, just before we were talking, before we start, we hit record, Brian, we were talking that like, you're going to be doing some work on you'll be doing some work on a miniseries coming up for Worlds Beyond Number. And I'm really excited to introduce you to the composer who'll be working on that miniseries with us. Yeah. Like, we were talking about that before the show started. So it's like, it's gone from a period of like anxiety, failure, and fear to very much like joy and community, which as much as I'm creatively proud of what we did with The Wizard, The Witch, and the Wild One, as a worker who creates labor and wealth value, whatever, call it what you will. I don't mean wealth as in like fancy cars. I mean wealth in the traditional like Marx.
Is that a yacht Marxist, in the background?
What Marxist sense. You know, that people depend on. I think that the last years have also seen me go from a place where I didn't know what I was doing and I was scared of it to a place where I'm surrounded by really smart people that I'm excited to work with in the future, not scared. And that's great. That's a huge change.
I know when we brought on Jay to do Jay did the even episodes of our Slug Blast.
And this is Jay Stroutman from Planet Arcana?
From Planet Arcana, yeah.
Great show. Great
show. Who also, great show, and they're just wrapping up. Actually, as this is getting released, they will be like an episode away from wrapping their first campaign, like 3.5 year campaign. Wait.
The feeling of wrapping, it's like the day after a wedding. You just, God, I'm so glad that shit's over.
I think Jay has finished the editing, so I think now it's just, you're just waiting. But so big congrats to them. But bringing Jay on for that series was, and I'm sure you feel this way to varying degrees, was one, a game changer for my mental health. Absolute game changer. Because then, like, it freed up time. I wasn't going week to week in the way that I was for, like, Wild Sea or Paint the Town Red or, like, some of our other seasons. And gave me more time, freed up more of my time to do other projects, which helped me financially, which made, you know, lessen the load on what our show needed to do. Which is more of a problem for, I guess it's still a problem for both of us, but more of a problem for me on the scale that we're operating on.
Oh, but also, yeah,
we did, you know, Jay sent me the first episode, and I remember one of the first choice, maybe like 15 minutes in, one of the choices they made, I never would have made. And I was like, oh, that, like, and I immediately messaged them, and I was like, oh, this was rad. Like, I would never would have thought to do, and it was something small. It was like a squeaky shoe or like a door sound effect in just the right spot where I was like, fuck, I never would have thought of that. And like, that was super exciting. And that was the thing I was hoping to get from it, was like bringing in other collaborators now means this will be heightened. It won't be fully mine. And I have to take my hand off. I mean, it's never fully mine. There's a whole cast.
Yeah, right.
But to take my hand even further off the scale of the project, to let other people in, to make something more interesting. And like I was already excited about it, but having like, it was great that like within the first 15 minutes, there was something that really hammered that in, that like, yes, this is good. And you made the right decision. And you already knew Jay was awesome. And Jay has proved it again and again.
It is a profound feeling to go from feeling that sort of awakening from being alone to being in a creative community that you trust and enjoy. I mean, that is as profound a change as going from being alone to being in a community of people just in your life. Yeah. It is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I'm very happy for you. Yeah.
But going back to what you said, the only reason that was possible was because MythWorks, who makes Slug Blaster, sponsored the season, gave us a $10,000 sponsorship, which allowed me to do that. Like, that was not possible with previous seasons. And now
it's brutal.
It is.
I mean, you know what this really gets to? And I don't want to turn this into like a political gab fest, but like, this is what happens. This is what, like, the capitalist alienation, the fact that we are all running terrified, scrambling up a 45 degree angle of like gravel, trying to climb up this mountain where we're sliding down all the time, right? Like, and we're doing it alone, is profoundly spiritually demeaning and destabilizing. We're not meant to do that. I'm not. I imagine some people can go off to a cabin in Wisconsin and write Emma Forever ago, and they're fine. And they're fine. They love it. But not me. I want to be with other people. I want to work with other people. I think it is just flat out a more meaningful life. But the fucking economy of it all, and the fact that we're all so desperate, and we don't live in a society that has, you know, socialized funding for the arts and things like that. And we're just so, also desperate for health insurance and all these things, you know, like, whereas in other countries, if those things are guaranteed, you can take more chances, right, on making creative projects and even non-creative projects, starting a new business, whatever. Spending time with your family, whatever.
When you have healthcare and you don't have to worry about that, the difference between a risk and a chance becomes profound.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, so it really fucking sucks that we need so much money to work in a way with other people that is so obviously better because it just creates a more meaningful life. Like, I feel that my life has more meaning when I am working creatively with others. And the fact that that has such a high price tag makes me fucking furious.
It's interesting, like, I knowing both of you for the last few years and watching you talk about this and just, like, my own personal perspective on what I find interesting from, like, an artist and a creative is, like, I think that I have watched my own perspective change of, like, and an ego-driven perspective, I think of, like, oh my god, that person did everything on this project. Like, when Taylor, you started this project, it was like, oh my god, Taylor did everything in that first episode? That's so impressive. I am now no longer impressed when someone chooses to make a martyr of themselves and do everything on their project. Like, I have found myself lose that like feeling of being impressed from like the auteur level of like, I think about it in game design. Like, I used to be really impressed by the game designer who would do the art, do the layout, you know, write the book, you know, publish the book. And like, it's way more interesting to me when you bring together a group of people to do all the pieces. And like, I know you didn't kill yourself to make it. Like, yeah. It's like, I don't feel good enjoying the thing you made if you you know, tortured yourself to make it. Like, there was a real feeling, Taylor, in those first couple seasons or first couple arcs where, like, I knew how much you were beating yourself down, like, with deadlines and stuff, where I'm like, I feel a little bad listening to this and enjoying it so much.
It's like when you're a kid and you go to the circus and you see, like, the dancing bear or the lion tamer. You're like, yeah. Cool, that's awesome. And then you get older and you're like, oh, those poor animals. This is just suffering on display.
I'm really just imagining Elliot like pulling up an episode of Worlds Beyond and being like, why is there blood on this podcast?
Right.
We encourage everyone to do not buy your podcast at Podcast Mills.
No.
Free-range podcast.
You want free-range podcast where they allow the producer to walk outside for at least half an hour a day.
But well, it's the I mean, same let's, thing. Let's like, it's
crazy.
The,
yeah, that's crazy.
Well, yeah, no, Brian's not allowed outside for more than 5 minutes a day.
I've got a window right there.
Right, he's got
today,
a window.
Today, a second bucket of fish heads for your food. You've been a good boy.
I'll be back.
But it's interesting the journey we've had as like a company as well is just... We all talked for a long time about not accepting the way Brian overworked himself, because Brian has taken, like, you know, the lion's share and at times 100% of post-production across our shows. And like watching him do this to himself and always being like, we got to find a way to fix this for you. And like not really having solutions and kind of letting the complacency of like being carried by somebody who is falling on that sword. And then I realized, like, I had a real growth moment with Slug Blaster where you wanted to bring on other sound designers, and I had a moment where I was like, oh, but that will change how the show sounds. Like, I had an ego moment about your sound design on our shows. And then, like, you're right, like, as soon as you do it and then it still sounds great, and even like at times it's like different choices, it's just like, why the hell was I thinking that way? And like, and like the improvement, like you said, in your mental health is so palpable. It's like, it's that's worth it every time.
We talk, my in my household, we say Jared Olson's name in the same reverence you would say for like a surgeon that cured your cancer.
There's a candle like, lit.
Yes, honestly, I was joking with my wife about this a few days ago. I was like, we should have a picture of Jared in the house with candles and just like for his health. I mean, it is, yeah, crossing that threshold is a it's financial. You know, the reason I was working so hard on my own was because I could not afford to pay anyone else to do what I was doing. Even now, with the growth the show has seen and like how well the show has performed on Patreon, if I paid a quote unquote real composer to make as much music as I am making for the show, it would outstrip. It would be 100% of my monthly. Like, I wouldn't be able to afford to pay any of my bills and or anyone else. It would be all the money that I make from Worlds Beyond Number. Like, I'm still working for less because I'm like the per minute of music rate that like industry composers will charge is still higher than what I am making for, you know. So I'm still doing it a little bit where I'm working way beyond what the money should be for the good of the show. But that, when we first launched, I mean, listen, I was not just penniless. I was so deep in debt. I had been living off, you know, my shows previously had been, you know, successful by some measure, but like buying all the software for the show and all the gear and everything, which and I made a lot of mistakes with that because I didn't know what I was doing. But I spent, I had already been living off credit cards. I was, you know, because I had, you know, not had an actual job since September 2019. And so, and the shows were doing okay, but not okay enough. And I was gearing up and I was paying people's salary, right, to get ready to, like, assembling this team to launch the show. And so I was deep in debt when the show launched. There was no money to bring anybody else on. And I felt that I had to do all the work because the only alternative was never getting out of debt. The only way to break free of that was to push myself to the limit of what I was capable of and do it all on my own, because the other way, the alternative was what? Like, work a full-time job and still stay in the same amount of debt forever. So, and this has nothing to do with Worlds Beyond Number. It has nothing to do with the creative industry. It has nothing to do with podcasts. That's just the state of what capitalism has done to our culture. Like, there's a million, there's hundreds of millions of people in the same situation as me, desperately needing help and but completely trapped by the financial system that we're into where they can't get it.
I do also just want to call out, I know you were saying it tongue-in-cheek, but to say a quote-unquote real producer, considering the amount of music you've produced for the show, I'm going to tell you to knock that the fuck off right now.
Now, maybe, yeah. Maybe a little bit now. Yeah.
I think in our last conversation, you weren't ready for that. But this one, you were going to make you be ready to be a real composer.
Yeah, you're going to get the fuck over it.
It's really strange to consider myself as a composer, like in the industry of people who do media composing, because I have maybe the best composing job in America. Like, as like my gig is maybe, if you look at it from a compositional perspective, I am one of the luckiest musicians in on earth right now. I have one of the coolest gigs. Like, every composer for film or TV or anything would kill to be in like the writer's room and to have a direct pre-production connection with the director where you can pitch ideas. Like, it's wild. But my rates are also dangerously competitive. Kind of an insult to everybody else. It's a crazy thing to think about it from just as me as like a composer and musician perspective. It's bonkers. And I backed into it. How dare I? Yeah, I think if most musicians knew what was going on with me, they would despise me.
We'll check with Behold if he's listening to this episode, if he's just fuming at you from his studio.
Oh, I guarantee.
I mean, can you imagine working your life to like go to school for this and everything and then like get really good at it, have all these professional things, and then that some fucking jackass goober just like lucked into it, taught himself off some YouTube tutorials and didn't get fired immediately? I'd hate him.
I think that there's one thing you mentioned there I want to touch on before we start to sort of round the corner on this conversation. It's that, like, you have this fun position of being in the writer's room, and I think that you've come to the end of book one now, and there were so many narrative payoffs, one giant one with this big steel reveal. And I'm curious, like, as composer, as somebody who thinks about like the sound design and sound of the episode, what does that level of narrative insight allow you to do that that I guess most composers don't get to do?
Oh, so much. I mean, it's absolutely crucial. When you work in sound design and music like this, you cannot support the story if you don't know what the story is, right? So, you know, me and Brennan were in conversation, and I'm so happy that me and Aubrey are in conversation now coming up for her campaign. But me and Brennan were in conversation from the get-go. I mean, we hashed out what, like, the big secret project of the Citadel was before episode one was recorded. I mean, wow. Like, we knew. I mean, and that was like a whole – afternoon meeting on one day, was just figuring that out. Like, how does that work in the setting? What's the cosmology of it? What's the philosophy of it? What you know, how does that interact with all the themes of the show, all the potential routes the characters could take in reaction to it and discovering and all that stuff? I mean, that, you know, that was one of the things. And the fact that Steele is who she is something that we knew from the get-go. That came completely from Brennan. That was, he walked into the meeting and being like, all right, one thing you gotta know is Steele's like Steele killed her parents. That's done. Which is fantastic. I mean, Brennan is like, that guy is like a truffle pig for story. You take him out into a forest, you don't see any mushrooms. That guy's like, mushrooms, there. There's a story beat. He is just, I mean, he's a great talker. He's good voices. But I think the real skill that good DMs have is like knowing, watching people play a game and knowing, oh, there's treasure buried right there in what they just said. And then having it come back later like a fucking sledgehammer across the jaw. But in some circumstances, before a word is played, like, we know. Like, this is the major thematic element of what the Citadel is actually up to. We knew that from day one. Steele as well. I mean, all the different. And you have to know it. As a composer, you have to know it. Otherwise, if I was in the dark, I would have scored Steele in a completely different way. And if I take that to an extreme, then I am manipulate, you know, I am, my job is to manipulate the emotions of the listener. But if I manipulate them in the wrong way, so if I don't know what Steele is up to and I get a bad vibe from her, I will start scoring her like a villain, like an obstacle. I will add tension and suspense, right? Because imagine Steele is fundamentally good, but is still like a domineering and controlling mother presence in Suvi's life. Then I'm definitely going to add a lot more tension and suspense to her scenes because I feel like I know what the tension and suspense there is, right? But if Brennan knows that she's going to try to be an actual capital V villain later, then I fucked up because then I've already revealed that she's dangerous, that there's a threat here because I misunderstood the circumstance. So instead, and we talk about this more, we're about to put out a hour and a half long deep dive into the score and music theory of the score for Wizard of the Witch and the Wild One out on our Patreon in the next few weeks sometime. Another great ad for the Worlds Beyond Number Patreon, folks. It just doesn't get better than that. Sorry, I'm required to say that.
As you should.
Plug away.
Yeah. But because I did know that what the Steele reveal was eventually going to be, I did not score her one way or the other. You hear a lot of warmth from her. If she asks a probing question about something scary, you might hear some tension and things. But I was very deliberate to not cast her as a threat or villain in the show, because I don't want people thinking that until they have to. And then when we knew the reveal was coming in arc four, so Steele never had a theme. Every faction, location, characters would have instrument families that represent them, or melodic themes, or even a tone or timbre that sort of represents their vibe. Steele never had one until the Battle of 12 Brooks. And the Battle of 12 Brooks happens at the very beginning. The Epiphany, the flagship of the Citadel's fleet, flies over the battlefield. That the theme you hear, the welcoming of the Epiphany, that becomes Steele's theme, which of course is a hack trick. We named the ship the Epiphany, you fucking suckers. And then, like, the Epiphany, you're hearing Epiphany, 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 and we're hearing that da-da-da-da-da-da-da theme behind it. And then when the Epiphany lands and she picks up Suvi, you hear the minor version of that theme. It's much more threatening now. And then, of course, when she enters the room, you hear that minor threatening version of the theme of Epiphany while Suvi is having this Epiphany. So we introduced her theme later in a much brighter, heroic way with the introduction of her flagship, which is a really great moment because it's very terrifying and intimidating, but it's sold as this like heroic moment, which adds to like the confusion that you're meant to feel about Steele up until the big reveal at the end of arc four. So that's a good example of where if I didn't know the real story, I would have failed as a composer. And because I knew it, we were able to structure the music around Steele, I think, very well.
That's awesome. Oh, I love that.
I've got one more question before we bring it to our final question, I think, of the interview. And over our past two interviews, we've asked, you know, that you asked us to ask you if you nailed it. And we think for book one, nailed it.
Yes. Thank you. Good. Yes. Thank you.
Looking ahead to campaign two, is there anything that you think for you as a composer, as a sound designer, as an editor, as a producer, that you haven't nailed yet for your own, for what you want it to be, that you are looking to campaign two as a space to grow in?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you this, you know, the music in book one of The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One was definitely meant to reference a lot of things that came before. I wanted people to think about the Back to the Future theme and John Williams and cartoons. You know, I wanted to remind people of these things in the past. I wanted it to feel nostalgic a little bit. I don't want that with the new story. The hard part is going to be making it feel new while kind of making you remember a little bit of some of the great old stuff. But it's really hard to write sci-fi synth music or big reverby space stuff without sounding like everything else, especially because so much production music and cheap online, like bedroom producer music, uses a lot of, you know, techno music and electronic music and easy synth stuff and all that, all those forms that gets played out so fucking much, just so much. It's so easy to throw on an arpeggiator on a synth and hold down some keys and that's your song. So I think the challenge for me is going to be, how do I reference the past without sounding like something that's just banal, without sounding like everybody else? Whereas sounding like everybody else is sometimes what I was exactly going for with The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One. That is not the case with Abrea's Game. I want to reference some things. I want you to feel like maybe you're listening to a cool pop song in 1983 from a British new wave band. But I don't want to sound like everybody else's space sounds. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to sound like a sci-fi channel space show. Where everything sounds interchangeable and the same, and nothing really has an emotional weight to it. I want it to be old but new in a way that we didn't really do with The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One. So that's the challenge. If you hear a lot of music on the new show that sounds like someone could have just grabbed it from, you know, Epidemic Sounds or whatever, I will have fucked up, I think.
I'll be looking forward to hearing it and seeing what you
do. I will fail. You know, but hopefully not a lot.
As long as you're just like continually failing forward and getting up, eventually you succeed. you get to the finish line.
Statistically. It takes
a lot longer.
Yeah. You got to turn yourself into a room of infinite monkeys.
Exactly.
Well, Taylor, it's been great to chat again. You know our final question of the show at this point, but we're going to throw it at you one more time. What are you bringing to the table today? And this is just our way of asking for you to recommend something, anything, everything to our listeners in Tabletop, out of Tabletop. What are you bringing to the table, Taylor Moore?
Here's what I'm bringing to the table. Other people. Find people in real life and do something with them. Just do it. Just do it. Just bring other people into your life, please.
Someone recently reminded me that the phrase "it takes a village" doesn't just have to refer to raising a child. It could just refer to living life. And for whatever reason, that really like buoyed my spirit.
I actually had a very similar conversation recently, Brian, with
we might have
one
just
of
had
my roommates
together. Oh no, okay, it's different.
it was talking to my roommate Robin, and Robin was saying how like they feel like they always need to have a village around, like that is like their way. And I was like, oh, I've never heard village used not about like a child, but I resonate and I like it.
And I'll tell you this, no one is coming to solve that problem for you. You know, it's like I talk about this with my friends all the time. We talked about it today, like how the system enforces almost like this alienation and a de facto solipsism capitalist atomization and things like that. But even a real practical work sense, especially if you're working as like a freelancer or a contractor in the creative world or any other world. But like the system might be responsible for putting us here, but no one's coming to fix that problem. Like if you want other people in your life, and you very much do, trust me, you have to proactively do it. And that takes some courage, but you just got to do it whether you think you got that courage or not. Get them. You got to save yourself.
Cavalry's not coming. You got to become the cavalry.
You got to go find the cavalry. They're there. The cavalry is waiting. But you got to climb the crest. You got to climb the ridge. You got to go up there and see them and find them and then go over. Hey, you guys are the cavalry? Like, yes. Do you need us? Yes.
I've been looking all over for you guys.
Yeah, all over. But you got to climb that hill first.
You were on the horses. You couldn't have come over the hill. I had to climb this thing.
Hey, there's a lot of hills, buddy. We can go over that hill, this hill. Come on.
I get it. But just like one more hill would have been appreciated, man.
Okay, maybe we just go back to town. And
I'm so sorry, guys. I brought snacks.
He's cool. He's cool, everybody.
I got homemade cookies. They're really good. I took the Levan Bakery cookie.
That's who you hope to meet in the desert with a cavalry, the guy with a big blue box of Levan chocolate chips. The horses can't eat them, but who cares?
That's fine.
So we'll be linking that in the bio.
Yeah, link in the bio to being around other people in real life.
Taylor, before we get out of here, you want to let people know where they can find you online if they're looking for you, and also where they can find Worlds Beyond Number?
Yeah, I'm mostly on Blue Sky for social media these days. You can find me at taylor.biz.bluesky. I don't know what the name is. Just Taylor Moore on there. Come on. And, of course, Worlds Beyond Number. You can find us wherever fine podcasts are coagulated and distributed. Whatever that
coagulated.
Coagulated. And, folks, we got the Worlds Beyond Number Patreon is extraordinary. Right now it is only $5 a month, and you get everything on there, including a lot of talk about the show. So if you're a fan of the show and you enjoyed this conversation that was specific to The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One today, you can find so much more like that on our Patreon, which is very good and very cheap.
There's that one episode that had that brilliant sound design, and it was the clearing, and I was like, man, you really leveled up. Like,
that's kind of a lesser really... work.
I think that's your opus. Works. I think that's probably your opus right there.
You think so? I don't even remember that much about it. It didn't seem very memorable.
I don't know. It stayed with me.
Yeah. Okay. I'll look back at it. Yeah. I think maybe you're not wrong. I'll go look and make sure it exists.
And if you want more gaming content from us here at Talk of the Table, you can check out the Many-Sided newsletter or become a member of the Many-Sided Media Discord. We can talk about this episode and all of our other episodes. And if you want to support us, check out the Many-Sided Media Patreon, where you'll get ad-free episodes of this. You'll get bonus roundtable discussions, talkbacks, and additional actual plays for our actual play podcast, My First Dungeon. As always, rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.